Hey guys, hope you're doing well. It's been a while, but we're back. We hope you've been adjusting well to the changes this pandemic has brought on. We have a special two-part episode for you this month since October is National Substance Abuse Prevention Month. The second episode will be led by Dr. Tim Brown in Farmcast for the Community. So give that one a listen too. Today we have with us a fellow P3, Kendall Anderson Hunt. She is part of GenRx, which she will explain in a bit. We're so glad that you can join us today to speak about this important topic. As pharmacists, we can have a big impact in our community to prevent substance abuse and help those who may be suffering from substance abuse disorders. All right, Kendall, go ahead and introduce yourself before we get into the question.
I'm super excited to be here. I don't know if y'all can tell by like the massive grin on my face, but I'm incredibly pumped. Like Kavya said, I am a P3. I'm a pharmacy school student in my third year. I have been involved in Generation Rx for a couple years, which I can get into later. This has been a passion of mine. I think what really kicked it off, I guess, to answer your question, as a P1, we listened to these two women from Georgia Overdose Prevention go through their story and their experience with substance use disorder in a very personal experience and kind of talk to us about the prevalence. And something just like clicked in my brain of like, this is so interesting. This is so prevalent and pharmacists can play a huge role in this. And I like just took off from that point forward. I remember, and this is going to sound kind of like wild, but I remember after that conversation with them, I went down and talked to them and said, thank you so much for talking to us. And I walked to their car with them and I just was like, give me all of the naloxone kits that you have. This is so important. I want to do everything I can to educate my community. And they did because they're incredible women. And I can get into a little bit more about naloxone later, but that's just really what kickstarted it for me because I realized how important the education and how important my role in this was. So I'm very, very pumped.
Well, we're excited to have you today too. I'm grinning too, just so you know. can you explain what GenRx is and your involvement in it?
Yes, absolutely. So GenRx or Generation Rx is the full name, is an operation underneath the larger umbrella of American Pharmacists Association, which is APHA. So I'm involved in APHA. I've been involved since my first semester of pharmacy school. And then after that conversation that I kind of previously alluded to with Georgia Overdose Prevention, I got involved in Generation Rx because the mission for Generation Rx is to educate the community about the dangers of misuse of prescription medications. And so more can like relate to the topic of today is, you know, the opioid epidemic and substance use disorder, but they really advocate for, you know, proper use of medications. And so we'll do things like Athens Recovery Fest, we'll do drug take back days. I was able to go to the Institute of Substance Use Disorder a couple years ago. So not this past summer, but the summer before, where pharmacists were able to talk about what they're doing in the community and in their careers for substance use disorder, which was really so interesting to listen to. I learned so much. After that, I was able to link up with Dr. Meryl Norton, who is kind of our resident like head in terms of substance use disorder, and he knows so much. So that was really cool to get to work with him. I worked with him on a couple projects, and then recently with Generation Rx, we were able to talk to some pre-med students about substance use disorder and stuff. So that was really cool. I have loved being involved in Generation Rx and all the opportunities it's provided me in terms of like my passion of educating the community. So, but yeah, that's a little bit about GenRx.
That's great. Thank you. What do you think that a pharmacist's role could be in this opioid epidemic, or what we can do as students, I guess, to help prepare ourselves as a pharmacist that will be involved?
A large question. I was thinking, I think our role is very expansive. I think obviously what we're doing right now, number one, educating ourselves. So we're in pharmacy school, we're learning, you know, we take tons of classes in pharmacology to learn about the mechanism of action and what happens when people take opioids. I think it's important to really take that to heart, to understand what's going on. I think it's important because that leads into this epidemic. So to kind of elaborate, a lot of what we see when patients are overdosing, or not necessarily patients, but people in general are overdosing on these medications, it's happening because of the respiratory depression. They're dying because their lungs are not able to take in the oxygen that they need because they're not breathing as much. And that happens because the opioids suppress their breathing. And normally when you take an opioid, so like, let's say, for example, I go and get my wisdom teeth taken out and I might take just a couple doses of you know, Percocet to help with the pain. That's not going to have that much of an impact. But you have patients with really severe chronic pain who are taking these medications for a really, really long time. That's when differential tolerance comes into play, because there are receptors these opioids can bind to. So the main one that we focus on is for pain, but other ones is in the lungs, which is where we get the respiratory depression. And then thirdly, in the GI is the other really big system. So people who are taking opioids can become really constipated over time. And so what I mean by differential tolerance is when patients take opioids, their tolerance will develop in the pain aspect, but it doesn't really change that much when it comes to the GI. And so they'll need to take more and more medication to help with their pain, but they don't see as much tolerance when it comes to the respiratory system or the GI system. So as they're increasing their opioid medication to kind of keep up with their pain response, they're further increasing their risk of respiratory depression and of GI complications. And so I think whenever that was really laid out and explained to me, it really clicked to me in my role as a pharmacist to kind of help my patients understand further down the line, if you need to take these medications chronically, this might happen. So education, I think, is really important. Secondly, being compassionate, which I know kind of sounds a little off, but yes, we want to be good stewards of these medications, but we need to do it very compassionate side. Pain is subjective. So when someone says they're in pain, we need to be able to treat their pain. I see a lot as my time as a student, I feel like there's maybe some resentment in the community in terms of when someone comes back to the pharmacy because they need more of their pain medication. There's a little bit of like, oh, that person is just addicted. They're abusing. I don't know. That might be the case. They might be going down that path where they might be needing more and more medication, but they're scared. I think that was the biggest thing for me is when I went to Institute was, yes, they might be needing more and more medication. They might be growing tolerant. They might be really dependent at this point on their pain medication, but they're coming back for more because they're scared of what's going to happen if they can't get it. They're going to be thrown into withdrawal. They're going to be thrown into even more pain than their initial, you know, inciting pain because their body is now dependent on this medication. Opioids are tricky. And I mean, that goes in plays back into the fact of educating ourselves as pharmacists. We need to understand how tricky these medications are. So when our patients are having complications, we can understand what's going on and we can be good stewards. We can encourage use of other methods for pain relief and try those methods first before we get to these trickier, more severe pain medications. But when it comes to people who need these medications for really severe pain, maybe they're older or maybe they or a cancer patient, at that point, we just need to be able to be compassionate and still be safe with the use of this medication, but do it in a way that is compassionate.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that opioid abuse is such a big problem. And working in community pharmacy, I've seen that there are times when patients have come to the pharmacy and then they're like, oh, I need this medication. And we're not sure because you have to double check and make sure that they're not abusing it and stuff like that. So it's kind of hard. So how do we help someone get through a substance use disorder? How do we like convey to them that we're here for them and we just want to help them?
Yeah, that's a good question. And to also kind of echo off your response, I've seen it too. It definitely, like you said, plays into how we need to be good stewards in terms of, you know, if someone comes in and they're a couple of days early. I mean, we as pharmacists are bound by law to practice a certain way. And it's there for a reason. We want these patients to be practicing safely. But I've just seen in the community, someone comes in with an early refill or what we like to call like a canned excuse where, you know, my dog ate my medications or whatever. And the pharmacist says like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, unfortunately, we aren't able to fill this medication. It's, you know, too early. And instead of turning around and just going along with your day and kind of understanding maybe where these patients are coming from, I've seen a couple instances, maybe not super common, but I've just seen a couple where over time, I think pharmacists can be jaded and just kind of roll their eyes at these patients and not necessarily be as empathetic and compassionate. So I definitely hope that, you know, as I go through my years, I can kind of check myself too as a pharmacist practicing and being like, these patients are scared. They just, they want to be able to not go into withdrawal if that's why they're early. You know, that's not always why someone's early. Sometimes they just don't know that they're early. So, but anyways, how to help someone, I guess I can go into kind of like the terminology. So a lot of the terms terms that we use today is substance use disorder. And we're trying to move the conversation away from the word addiction. And while these patients are addicted, the reason why we're changing the terminology to substance use disorder is to kind of help with stigma, because this is a disease. A lot of patients who go into substance use disorder and have real problems, there is a predisposition and it is a disease and they need help. And we don't want people to feel afraid to ask for help. And while it can be hard, it makes it easier when you have pharmacists and clinicians and nurses and all these, the whole healthcare team, understanding that, you know, this is a disorder or a disease. We should approach it almost the same way as we approach someone with hypertension or diabetes, even though it is a little bit more complex in terms of treatment, because the treatment really is that while they're in the disorder and really kind of in the cycle of things, it's really hard to do anything for these people. I have listened to people talk about their experiences, and what's interesting to me, and whenever I was working with Dr. Norton and he kind of goes through the pathway of substance use disorder, patients who really progress, what happens is their brain chemistry gets so changed and altered trying to adapt and try and find some kind of homeostasis and some normality that it confuses the drug with what we call dynorphins. Dynorphins are what are released in our brain when we're like around our friends or our family. It's what is released whenever we're born. That's why they say that whenever people are like on their deathbed, whenever they're dying, they say they cry out for their moms. And that's because whenever you're born, you release dynorphins and you have that connection with your mother right when you're born, which I think is really cool. Things are being created synthetically. So whenever opioids are being abused, they are depleting these dynorphins, and whatever their drug of choice is replacing their family, their friend, to the extent where they don't really see anything wrong with it. And so in terms of what can we do to help, there's not a lot, because they see their drug of choice as the most important thing in their life. In the same way that I see my mom as a very important person in my life. When it comes to support, like if I were to go work in a clinic, I think it's really important to support the families and kind of help them understand. One of the pharmacists at the Institute of Substance Use Disorder actually works in a family clinic, and listening to some of his stories were really profound. And he was trying to explain to like these children of parents who are actively in recovery or in a rehab facility for substance use disorder. And these kids think it's their fault and that their parent don't love them, that they're choosing this drug over them. And it's not the kid's fault. It's definitely important to try and provide as much support to the families as possible, because it can be a little interesting in terms of family dynamics, because these kids see their parent, you know, choosing a medication over spending time with them. And we need to be able to kind of help the families understand that it's not you, it's this brain chemistry that's messed up, it's this disease. We need to work to fight this disease. It's not a choice your parent is making. So supporting the family, doing the best you can to support the individual dealing with substance use disorder, and encouraging them to seek help once they are ready to seek help, I think it's the most important thing. You know, knowing, you know, where they can go, you know, like looking up resources to try and like where is the nearest Narcotics Anonymous meeting to my house. So whenever my friend is ready to, you know, admit that there is a problem and say that they need help, I can drive them to this meeting. I've already looked up the resources and I can get them there. It is really the most important thing that we can do. And then they help, and there are lots of medications that can kind of help in terms of the withdrawal effect of getting off these medications, because the withdrawal is, like I said, is scary and painful. And so in terms of the non like social side of the treatment, in terms of dealing with withdrawal, there are medications that can act on those receptors, but not to the extent that provide the substance abuse, but it'll help them kind of wean themselves off of the medication as well.
You're so considerate and passionate about it. I'm pretty sure everyone listening wants you as their future pharmacist. But yeah, so on to our next question. I know you mentioned earlier about naloxone, but for those that are listening that might not know, you know, what it exactly is, do you mind just explaining a little bit about what it is and its importance?
Yes, I love naloxone, so I'd love to talk about it. So like I said earlier, with the talk with the Georgia Overdose Prevention ladies, my initial exposure was really to naloxone. I mean, they talked about their stories with their family history in terms of substance use disorder. One of the women had a son who really struggled with the disorder and going in and out of rehab, and he eventually passed away. And so it was just so impactful to hear her story. But the second part of their journey was to listen to them talk about naloxone, which is why I got so excited about it, which is why I walked to their car and grabbed 19 boxes and was like, I'm going to give this to everyone I know. To kind of talk about it, opioids act on the mu receptor in our body to help modulate the pain that we're experiencing. And naloxone is an antagonist at that receptor. And actually your body prefers the naloxone molecule over the opioid molecule. So whenever someone is taking an opioid and you give them naloxone, the naloxone comes in and rips pretty much the opioid off the receptor and reverses its activity, which is fantastic when someone is having an overdose. So they have taken a lot of the medication, or maybe they're using heroin or some kind of synthetic on the street, and they're having that respiratory depression I was talking about, and they're having all these symptoms of an overdose. You can give naloxone and it will bring them back to life, and it happens so fast and it's super cool. And the coolest thing about naloxone is that anyone can use it in the state of Georgia. At least I know that there are a lot of other states who also have collaborative agreements and have laws that protect the citizens. But in Georgia, we have the 911 amnesty law, which I heard a lot about whenever I was an undergrad, just because it's a topic that a lot of people want to make undergraduate students aware of. Because if someone's having, you know, in terms of alcohol, and if you're having, if you had too much and you're having alcohol poisoning, you know, because it happens, there have been stories where students have had too much alcohol, they're having alcohol poisoning, they're afraid to call for help because they're afraid they're going to get in trouble. And so they don't. And so that's how I heard about the 911 amnesty law, was that education from coming into school. And I was doing all of the, you know, the modules and stuff that you do as a freshman. I was like, oh, there's a law. That's great. And whenever I was a P1 in pharmacy school and listening to these women talk about the 911 amnesty law, I learned that the amnesty law was first created regarding naloxone. And it's the same concept where if someone's overdosing and you're there and you have naloxone, you can administer it. You don't have to be a physician. You don't have to be a nurse. You don't have to be a PA. As long as you're acting in good faith and you have a naloxone kit, you can administer it and you're protected underneath this law, which I thought was incredibly cool. And I was like, this is amazing. And the coolest thing about it is there's tons of different formulations. And obviously it's a little bit scarier if you're, you know, they call it a lay person, but if you're just someone in the community and someone's overdosing and the only naloxone that's available is like a vial and a syringe, like that's a little bit more scary. But what the women from Georgia Overdose Prevention were kind of giving out were these boxes of a naloxone nasal spray. And there's not a lot of side effects associated with naloxone. I mean, I have a box upstairs and I could probably go like do a nasal spray of the naloxone and I would have very minimal side effects. And so the coolest thing is there's not a ton of risk associated with giving it. There's a ton of benefit in giving it. And so really how it works, it has a really fast mechanism of action. It acts in about 2 to 5 minutes of someone receiving it. So if someone is overdosing and you see them, you can pull out your naloxone, squirt a nasal spray in their nose, and it'll happen in about 2 to 5 minutes. You can see the color return back in their face and they will be walking around like normal. The other thing to consider though with naloxone, it's really has a really short half-life. So there have been reports of, like, for instance, something that people do, and I guess this kind of plays into Generation RX's mission of proper disposal of medications, but there was a kid who had taken a fentanyl patch, and obviously fentanyl patches are supposed to be used on the site of the area for pain, and he had taken it in order to get a faster absorption and stuck it in his mouth. And the parents walk in and see their son overdosing, and that they had apparently had issues with this before. Maybe he was a substance use disorder individual and they had naloxone at home. So they walked in, did the naloxone. 2 minutes later, kid is doing great. He's fine. He's alive. They did not remove the fentanyl patch from his mouth. So they leave. And because naloxone has a shorter half-life, it wears off. And then you have the reabsorption of the opioid in the body. And they came back and he was back under. And so that's something to note with naloxone, is it has a really short half-life. So I don't know, you know, if you're listening to this and you do have a naloxone kit and you do come into a situation where, you know, you are administering it, it's just really important to stay with the individual that is receiving the naloxone. But like I kind of said at the beginning, was your body prefers the naloxone over the opioid. And so whenever the naloxone is given, it rips the opioid off the receptor. Well, what was the opioid doing? It was providing pain relief. And so whenever you give the naloxone and you're ripping that opioid off, you're going to save someone's life, which is like level one on the list of things to do. But when they wake up, they're going to be in a world of pain. The pain that they were trying to avoid with taking the medication and the pain of withdrawal. It's all going to hit them all at once, but they're going to be very thankful that they're alive.
Your passion is just really inspiring, I just have to say.
Yeah, thank you.
So we can all agree that the opioid epidemic is increasing each time. And so what I'm curious about is, What are the stats right now in the U.S. and how can we help combat it in our own community?
That is a fantastic question. I guess there have been several phases in terms of opioid over like use. I think there was definitely an age of heroin usage, which was kind of the first big opioid. And just to clarify, I guess kind of backtracking, I don't want to digress too much, but naloxone only works on opioids. So if there's an issue with another drug like a benzodiazepine or marijuana, cocaine, any other drug that you might think, it's not going to work on those drugs. But sometimes if someone's overdosing, like I said, there's really low risk in giving naloxone. So you could give someone naloxone, even if you don't really know if it was an opioid cause, just to be sure. But the first big opioid really was heroin in terms of popularity. In the graphs that I've seen, you just see a large prevalence in like the early 2000s, at least, and even into the 90s of just like heroin usage. Starting in the early 2000s, you see prescription drug use increasing. And when I'm talking about the increase, I'm talking about the deaths that we see and the cause of the death. So since you see this increase, this slow increase in the abuse and deaths caused from prescription medications like Percocet and Norco are the really big ones. And then you have like oxycodone, which is like by itself, not in combination with acetaminophen, but those are all the big ones. If anyone's seen the Netflix show, The Pharmacist, that's what the issue was, is there were physicians who were running pill mills and selling prescriptions for these opioid medications, and they were going to pharmacies to get them filled, and then they were diverting these medications onto the streets for people who were addicted. So we see all of that happening, rising in the 2000s, and then that actually started to decrease because of this epidemic and a lot of the awareness and the deaths that were happening with it. I mean, we're seeing some of the stabilization and maybe even a decrease in the prescription side of things, but there was like a logarithmic increase in the synthetic uses of opioids like fentanyl, and then all of the synthetics of fentanyl. We can't control it as easily when it's not coming from, you know, our pharmacies. You know, the FDA and the CDC were able to pinpoint that, and they were able to really start putting the microscope on physicians and prescribing practices for physicians. And it's like, we don't need to be prescribing opioids first line for things that we can probably take care of with a high dose of ibuprofen. You know, like, let's try our other pain medications first and really get better at managing these medications and being good stewards of opioids. And then we saw the microscope go onto the pharmacies. So if you see a prescription for an indication that doesn't really, like, why would they be, you know, be vigilant, call the physician, get an explanation, suggest the use of maybe a different analgesic. The like liability started really falling on both the pharmacy and the physicians. And so now we have things like the PDMP, which so we can see when someone drops off a prescription, did they fill an opioid at a different pharmacy a couple of days ago? So we can know how many opioids are in the hands of individuals. And so we saw a large kind of crackdown on that usage. And so we are now seeing a large increase in the synthetics and the fentanyl, which are incredibly potent medications. There's not a lot of guidance. That's why we're seeing so many deaths due to these really potent synthetic medications, is they're so potent and we can't manage it like we can manage physician prescribing and pharmacy practices. And so that's a little scary. When I was looking at some of the graphs from recent years, I was actually kind of surprised. I mean, we are still seeing an increase, especially from baseline, from where we were at. We are still very high. But from the last couple of years, Georgia has actually seen a statistically significant decrease in deaths, at least. And that might be due to the education that's going around and the availability of naloxone, because naloxone is what we can use to bring someone back that's having an overdose. So that could be playing a role. And then a lot of states are just seeing maybe not so much as a very drastic increase, but they're just still staying the same in terms of their death. It's still a large issue. I think it's almost getting harder to, and that's just my personal opinion, with the fact that, you know, we have cracked down a lot on the prescribing practices and how we're administering from the pharmacy. We're now just seeing almost like something that we can't necessarily control because these medications are being now used elsewhere. So that's kind of from what I've seen and a lot of the research that I've done in terms of the prevalence. I don't know if there was another part of that question that I did not answer. I'm sorry if that was the case.
No, you're good. That was all very informative. So do you have any resources that you can think of that might be beneficial for anyone?
Yeah, kind of like what I stated earlier, knowing where to find a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. You can go to na.org and you can search your zip code in the city and there'll be a list of all the Narcotics Anonymous. It's the same thing as like Alcoholics Anonymous, but for people who are having issues with opioids or any kind of narcotic. One of the coolest things on the topic about the Institute was they were able to show us what one of those meetings are like. So there were people in attendance at the meeting who had been in recovery for several years, you know, 10, 25, 50 years. In recovery, and they sat down at their Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and we as students were able to sit behind them because they sat in a circle and they had chairs kind of going back behind the circle that you can just sit in and listen. And they started off with just kind of showing us how these meetings usually go. And so they kind of, it was more of a, I guess, a lecture. So they talked about like the structure of the meeting, what happens, how it goes. And then as the days went on in the conference, they would say, okay, we're going to do our Narcotics Anonymous meeting now. And they would invite all of us to come in and listen, and they would stand up and they would talk. And I really liked at least knowing what it is like to be in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. So I, you know, if I'm ever in a situation where I need to refer someone, I know how to refer someone. We go to na.org and search my zip code and I can find a meeting that's accepting people. There's a lot of them that are doing virtual meetings right now because of COVID-19. And then you can go with someone if it's an open meeting and know what to expect, which I thought was really cool. When I was doing a little bit of research too, there's a book by Dr. Al Mooney, who is a physician. He's an MD. And he wrote a book called My Life in Recovery, which from what I've heard is like the Bible when it comes to learning about recovery and trying to get yourself there. Obviously going to an NA meeting is an incredible resource because you are able to build that community. But from what I've heard is that this book is really good. I think if you think about it, it's coming from a physician's perspective. And I think it is important to note that substance use disorder does not really care who you are. So you can be a physician or a pharmacist. And oftentimes you see higher prevalence in pharmacists because we have access to those medications and it can be stressful sometimes. So if you look at, you know, rates of substance use disorder in pharmacists, they're not low. They're not skyrocketing, but they do exist. This was a physician, an MD, who had an experience with substance use disorder, and he wrote about his road to recovery. And I think it's really cool to get it from a physician's perspective because they are knowledgeable too about these drugs and how they work. So I've heard that that resource is really incredible. And then in terms of being a student and going back, educating yourself the best you can, knowing how these medications work, because they, like I said, they're tricky. We need to be able to be good stewards. And so the best resource that you can do at this point in time is really know how these medications work and what it means when someone needs an increased dose because they're, you know, body is kind of becoming tolerant to the medication and what's happening. So those are some of the resources that I had.
Wow, thank you. Those are really great resources to have. And with that, do you have any additional thoughts or anything you want to share?
Let me think. I guess the biggest message as of right now is we need to remove the stigma. These patients have a disorder and their brain chemistry is altered and they need help. And it's hard because it's not like someone's walking in with hypertension and you're like, okay, you need to be put on a blood pressure medication, and they walk away and they take the medication. It's not that simple. It's really complicated, and it doesn't make it easier when we're throwing around terms like addiction and we're thinking of these people as lesser members of society or that they can't recover, because people can recover.
Thank you so much, Kendall. We're so thankful that you could speak to us today. It's great to see a student being so passionate about a cause like this. We need more future pharmacists like you in our community. We hope you enjoyed and learned something from this month's episode. Don't forget to check out Dr. Brown's episode with the new Miss America PharmD candidate Camille Schreier on PharmCast for the Community. Join us again next month for an episode on diversity with the college's very own Director of Diversity Programs, Dr. Vivia Hill-Silcott. As always, we want to thank you, our listeners, for your support. We also have a special announcement today. We've added 3 new farm dogs to our crew. Please help us congratulate and welcome our new P1 producer, Bobby Patel, our new P2 producer, Uresi Ojibi, and our new social media chair, Lillian Zulu. Last but not least, stay active on our social media, at UGA Farmcast 19, and let us know if you have any comments, questions, ideas, or feedback. We can't wait to hear from you. Remember to wear your masks, wash your hands frequently, and stay 6 feet apart. Stay awesome, stay healthy, and go Dawgs.